go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The Friday on the front porch. And a happy Friday on the front porch it is. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, your source for conversation radio of a decidedly progressive nature. Available at headonradionetwork.com and available on a wide variety of streaming apps for your tablets and smartphone devices. We recommend TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio, either of which is a good choice. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I said it's a happy Friday on the front porch. It is a classic Friday on the front porch. It is beautiful and late June hot here in the hills and hollers. Getting up close to 90. Yeah, I know there are people in other parts of the country going, I'll be quiet, close to 90, please. But it is. It's hot for the hills. Some high, fluffy clouds blowing about. Not any rain to speak of. A little bit here and there, but nothing much, no. And I mean, yeah, this is a front porch kind of Friday. And it's a happy day because I can announce that between last night and the close of the show and today, y'all did it. You did it. You got us to the end of June fully funded. That means we got a July. And thanks go out to everyone all month long who helped us do it. Thanks to Patrick. Thanks to Gregory. Thank you to Gene. Thank you. I'm going down through the list here. Just takes a second. I want to make sure everybody gets thanked. Thank you, Randy, from a couple of nights ago. And thank you to Gary. Thank you, all of you. Thank you to Joseph. It is an amazing thing. And deeply, deeply appreciated. Sorry, I'm multitasking here for just a minute. And, well, typed my password in wrong on the Skype. Oh, well. Now, that's all better. So the Skype line's all ready to go, and the traditional telephone lines are ready to go. And we are ready for Friday on the front porch. Oh, and a reminder, a program note. The very last Prism American History chat session will take place this Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. It'll be carried live on the Horn Stream, and you can also watch it over at prismwv.org, or barring that, at ustream.tv, you can watch it on the Prism channel. I'm going to miss this, and I think the people who have tuned into it regularly will miss it as well. It has been something incredibly special. Of course, one needs to remember that Dr. Bill O'Brien is extending the mission of the PRISM Project with the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, the discussions from which you can hear Monday through Wednesday of every week from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 to 3 Pacific. So please continue to tune in or get the podcast of Dr. Bill. I messed up a couple of days ago, so we're missing one this week. My apologies. Sometimes I forget to throw the third switch. Something else of note, it's the sign-in. It's the sign-in billboard that you see when you sign into the chat room this evening. Fun fact, there have been over 200 Horn Malloy Friday night Skype groups, and over 100 people have participated over the years now. There will be another one tonight following Malloy and Rick Smith, about midnight-ish. And, of course, you're welcome to join in. And just, well, if you go looking for it, you'll find it on Skype. Ah, it is. It's a wonderful little free-form, open-sourced conversation that ranges all over the place. So there's that. A reminder, I will be live from this studio all of next week. Well, there's the 4th of July holiday coming up. We'll play that by ear. I mean, I know we won't be on the air for the 4th of July. Not sure about the 5th. And then the following Monday I'll be in D.C. and we'll be broadcasting live from D.C. And for a couple of weeks at the very least. So there's that. Now, where to begin with this Friday on the front porch? I've got something here, and I've mentioned before that I am a daily reader of Charlie Pierce's blog over at Esquire.com. And I feel a sort of kinship with what I see here for his final post of the weekend. And it is a quote from something by a man named Glenn Smith, who is a progressive Texan. And it's one of those things that just really annoys almost all of us. You know, we fundraise here to keep the horn on the air, and we do so quite modestly. Thank you, Jude, for the help you just provided. That's wonderful. We are more than to the good for the month, and that is tremendously helpful going into the new one. We fundraise modestly here just to keep this thing going, occasionally fixing equipment and things that do go bad from time to time. But Glenn Smith down in Texas, who just saw, as did many of us, the heroic performance of Wendy Davis in filibustering SB 5. And by the way, Beth sent me a hilarious article last night from Salon. You can go and find it over there. Some supporters of Texas State Senator Wendy Davis are having a lovely time adding, and this is a phenomenon you see more and more, people making their points of view known by adding reviews to items, to products over at Amazon. And so there have been some delightful reviews of the shoes that Senator Wendy Davis wore on the page for those particular shoes, and I think they're Mizuno's, over at Amazon. Absolutely hilarious. I highly recommend you check them out. But the other side of this is that, Charlie Pierce writes, "My pal Glenn Smith, who's been fighting the madness down in Texas for longer than many of y'all have been alive, is pretty damn fed up with the national Democrats who don't notice Texas until somebody like Wendy Davis raises hell." He writes, and I'm going to read what the excerpt that Mr. Pierce provides. But I don't just do this gratuitously. It is a part, and frankly, it is a good conversation for us to all have. It is a part of a larger problem, and we'll round it out. Mr. Glenn Smith writes, "So we've been working our asses off down here, and Wendy and the Democrats had a good couple of days. Then today, on my email, I'm getting flooded with DLCC and DSCC and D-whatever the emails raising money off of Senator Davis." Well, he says raising money off of her. I say raising money on her back. I've seen some of these, too. And they come out like lickety-split, like lightning bolts. They're that fast. "National Democrats," Glenn Smith writes, "treat Texas as an extraction economy, and I am effing sick of it. Not one person who had anything to do with those national solicitations has a clue who Wendy Davis is. So, you national Democratic, stick it. You can use celebrity politics to sucker Texas donors, and you can sucker national donors into exploiting our celebrities. While you're at it, real people you claim to care about are getting sick and dying under GOP policies here. Children are not being educated. Women are made second-class citizens. So, Democrats, if you'll spend money in Egypt or Syria or wherever why not Texas? I'm truly sick of your celebrity obsession and your willingness to let Third World Texas fund your campaigns while people here suffer and die." He said a mouthful, didn't he? And the reason this grabbed my attention was because it is a phenomenon that is not isolated to this particular incident, nor to this particular genre. I know this because here in Appalachia, and people are finding it out in other parts of the country dealing with other issues where communities are being poisoned by extraction industries, fracking, Keystone XL pipeline, there's always an overarching national organization that is willing to fundraise on the backs of the people who are actually taking the risks and doing the hard labor. And it is, well, it's past trouble. What kind of an effort, turning to Texas, and Texans can tell me this far better than I can tell you. What kind of an effort has been made by the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party, lately to help a state that really is getting bluer by the day turn blue? Now, the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid expansion, you know, you'd like to, The way the Affordable Care Act was originally set up, Texas would have been compelled to participate in it. But as you recall from our discussion, that was the real, real problem with the Affordable Care Act, that the Supreme Court understood that they damned well had to get out of the way, because that was universal, single-payer health care. And it could not be allowed to go forward. And in fact, Isaac pointed out to me today that my own state of West by God, Virginia, almost level, is incidentally going to raid Medicaid funds in order to balance the budget on the backs of people who desperately need health care. That's an overarching problem, this whole idea that the backs of people who are actually in the so-called trenches are the ones that need to also carry the weight of a balanced budget. In the Senate and in the House, hungry people are carrying the balance of the budget on their backs for the farm bill. Poisoned people get fundraising done off their backs by national so-called green organizations, with very damned little ever coming back into the communities. Politically, we have this story out of Texas. If you're being fracked where you live, there's somebody fundraising on your fracked back. If you're struggling against the Keystone XL pipeline where you live, there's a national green organization fracking that's fundraising off of your back. There's an old saying out there about standing on the shoulders of giants. Well, in 2013, it seems that there is a real movement toward fundraising on the backs of the weak, the weary, and the wounded. It's kind of ugly, isn't it? I'd love for Texas to have the Medicaid expansion. God knows the millions of human beings who do not have health care in that state but would, with the Medicaid expansion, would probably like to have it themselves. The Medicaid expansion numbers in the so-called red states, the preferences by people, are pretty convincing. Even in places like Alabama stand and Texas stand, the people want it. They are being kept from it by the people who have gerrymandered themselves into jobs. So, just, I didn't say, well, I said frack. But anyway, you get the idea. Sergi writing in, subject line, National Dems effort, based on this excerpt that I just read from Charlie Pierce's post. You know the amount of effort a kid who waits until the night before a big project is due to said project? That's about the amount of effort that the National Dems put into Texas ever since what's-his-name's 50-state strategy got thrown to the wayside. That would be Howard Dean. Texas has had very little put into it. Sergi, signed Sergi, shitty diorama, Kyle. But that's true. Ever since Howard Dean's 50-state strategy was thrown out in favor of the low-hanging fruit strategy of Rahm Emanuel et al., there's no interest in propping up and supporting and giving encouragement to the progressives who labor sometimes in fear, but more often than not in grim determination in places like Louisiana stand and Mississippi stand and Georgia stand and Texas stand. And I know they're there, and I know they are there in significant numbers because I know a lot of them. So they will fundraise on Wendy Davis's back and do next to nothing for the communities from which they are drawing said funds. So that is, I suggest, a pretty good starting place. It is, however, Friday on the front porch, and this is, in fact, conversation radio. So let us, by all means, go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Click. Okay. Well, you'll have that. Oh, well. So, you know, there's that to ponder. But at the same time, a couple of other stories that I find interesting because they manifest the same sort of attitude And one comes out of Tennessee, and one comes out of Pennsylvania. This is where the real threat to civil liberties lies. This story goes back about a week. It concerns the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. And it concerns a meeting in Murray County, M-A-U-R-Y, if you want to look it up, Murray County, Tennessee. The meeting was organized by State Representative Sheila Butt. She's a Republican from Columbia, Tennessee, a lovely little town. Home of a little restaurant I was introduced to several years back, called the Catfish Campus. And yes, it is yummy. They serve these delightful green tomato pickles with their as a complement to their specialty, the fried catfish. Oh my God. But that's just an aside. Residents of Murray County and Columbia, Tennessee, were contacting their state representative, Sheila Butt, the Republican. And to her credit, she listened to their complaints. And she called this hearing with the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation to discuss why it is that her constituents were getting sick. They're being poisoned for some reason. Well, the Tennessean, which is the newspaper in Nashville, which is not at all far from Columbia, maybe, 50, 60 miles tops. People showed up for this meeting, and the Tennessean obtained an audio recording of what was said. People telling the TDEC about cloudy, odd-tasting water. And this is the response of the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, TDEC. And the response is, in a word, bizarre. Okay, it'll unpause just any minute now. Not only is the response bizarre, the response is also kind of fascist. Yeah. Actually, a lot fascist.
You might really like, I think you're trying to answer your question.
Look, you guys have come up here and expressed concerns about water quality on several occasions. You brought us a stack of complaints. We called every one of them and said, do you have water problems? Do you want us to come test your water? Guess how many we got to say?
I've got your report right here, so I know exactly.
Yeah.
Is one phone call a sufficient investigation of such serious complaint?
Well, we called them and said, do you want us to come down and test your water? No.
Let me
throw one thing out there just so you're aware, okay? We take water quality very seriously, very, very seriously. But you need to make sure that when you make water quality complaints, you have a basis, because federally, if there's no water quality issues, that can be considered under Homeland Security an act of terrorism.
Can you say that again, please?
What I'm saying is, if you've got concerns about your drinking water, that's very important. We take that very seriously. But under federal regulations, if you make allegations against the public water supply that are unfounded, then that can be considered under Homeland Security an act of terrorism, because you're trying to allege things.
And who would the U be in this case, Mr. Smith?
I'm just saying, I'm not making any accusations.
I was just saying.
I'm telling you so that you understand.
Wow. And thanks to our friends at SOCM. Long ago, SOCM stood for Save Our Cumberland Mountains. It now stands for Statewide Organizing for Community Empowerment. Thanks to SOCM for the work they did in getting that recording out, because it's important. That was a man by the name of Sherwin Smith, Deputy Director of the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, Division of Water Resources. It is one of the more bizarre and bald-faced lies that I've lately heard. And given what I do every day, I read a lot of them. Holy mackerel. Making a complaint. I mean, I'm trying to put this into some sort of framework that I understand from a legal perspective. You know, I'm not a lawyer or anything, but I did have the education. And so what is he saying? That has he created a new cause of action called water slander or public utility slander? The gravamen of his complaint seemed to be that people didn't want their water tested, but they wanted to. Well, there's a nexus here, and it is the nexus between distrust of government that has been created in this country over the course of years, decades, a generation or two or three or all, and the natural concern that one feels when one's water is anything other than water. And typically, if you know anything about the geography and geology of a place like Murray County, Tennessee, the water is not terrible, or should not be terrible, because its aquifer is overlain by a huge, huge layer of limestone. A lot of calcium in that water. And that could account for some of the cloudiness. I don't know. But you should be able to, you should get pretty good water. Unless, of course, they might happen to be, well, I don't know, fracking. Or something along those lines. Or if you've got some sort of industrial polluting operation sitting hard by the stream out of which the water supply is taken. Get that. Complaining about the quality of water, this guy speciously alleges, can be considered an act of terrorism? Is that where we're going? It kind of looks like, yeah. And then Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, where the wildly unpopular governor there, Corbett, unlike his colleague Kasich in Ohio, unlike even Rick Snyder in Michigan, unlike old hatchet-faced Jan Brewer in Arizona, or Rick Scott in Florida, or even my allegedly Democratic governor, oh, it is to laugh, Earl Ray Tomlin, here in West Virginia, he don't want none of that Medicaid expansion. Remember, Pennsylvania is Pittsburgh in the west and Philadelphia in the east and Alabama in the middle, hence the accent, which isn't right, but you get the idea. this particular incident is the story of an activist who showed up to protest Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's refusal to bring Pennsylvania into the fold of the Medicaid expansion, which, of course, would bring about 700,000 working Pennsylvanians under the umbrella of Medicaid so that they could actually have health care. So here's what happened. About a dozen uninsured Pennsylvanians staged a sit-in at the state capitol this past Wednesday, Harrisburg. They were then kicked out of the state capitol. You know, because, well, it might be the people's building, but it ain't really the people's building. You know what I mean? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. They were kicked out of the building, but a number of them followed up by walking down the sidewalk peaceably, nonviolently, to the governor's mansion. That's where the story of A.J. Marin begins. A.J. Marin is a health care activist. He had some of that colored chalk that we frequently give to little kids so they'll occupy their time by drawing on the sidewalk instead of going and finding, you know, mommy or daddy's spray paint and using that. Yeah. Because when it rains, chalk washes away. Well, after being kicked out of the state capitol and having walked down to the governor's mansion, A.J. Marin took some of that colored chalk and wrote the following on the sidewalk. He wrote, "Corbett," meaning Governor Tom Corbett, "Corbett has health care. We should too." Wow. Pretty strong stuff. I mean, if it got, I don't know, if the language was any tougher, it would probably have a self-executing recording of Kumbaya playing alongside it. Maybe the distant sound of a rattling tambourine. The message being, of course, that the people of Pennsylvania should have the same rights, if not exactly identical access, that the governor has. It's Medicaid. And a reminder, for the first 3 years of the program, it is entirely funded by the federal government to a level of 100%. After 3 years, that contribution can drop, but never drops below 90%. So the most that Pennsylvania would ever have to pay would be something on the order of 10% of its annual Medicaid budget. That's all it would have to contribute. 10%. 10 miserable, measly percent. So A.J. Marin, simply exercising what we in this country like to call freedom of speech, writes, "Corbett has health care. We should too." That's when the police showed up. And arrested, no kidding, arrested A.J. Marin. The citation that he issued to A.J. Marin read as follows. The above, meaning A.J. Marin, did engage in an charged with disorderly conduct. I find it difficult to imagine being disorderly at the same time as you're trying to write letters and get them spelled right. Remember, this guy's not a teabagger. Spelling counts. I can't imagine being disorderly and doing that at the same time. I just can't. the charge, disorderly conduct. The above did engage in an action that served no legitimate purpose in that he did write derogatory remark about the governor on the sidewalk. My God, I haven't heard anything like that since John Adams was trying to enforce the Alien and Sedition Act in what, 1799, 1800? Whew. And what does that mean? No, served no legitimate purpose. Since when are the police empowered to determine what political speech is legitimate and what is not? That's pretty astonishing. No legitimate purpose. And while we're analyzing, let's take a quick look at the cognitive skills of Officer Friendly here. Now again, I'm not gilding the lily or elaborating or adding anything to or taking anything away from what was written on the sidewalk in chalk. It simply says, Corbett has health care. We should too. All right, quick trip to the dictionary. Because I want to see if I've completely lost my mind or the police have gotten out in front of the rest of us on the language or what. Okay. Derogatory. From the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, 4th edition. Derogatory. Adjective. Disparaging. Belittling. Tending to detract or diminish. From Collins' English Dictionary, Complete and Unabridged. Derogatory, tending or intended to detract, disparage, or belittle, intentionally offensive. From the Random House Kennerman Webster's College Dictionary, derogatory, belittling, disparaging. From the Thesaurus, derogatory, expressive of low opinion, derogatory comments, disparaging remarks about the new house. Synonyms for derogatory: disparaging, damaging, offensive, slighting, detracting, belittling, unfavorable, unflattering, dishonoring, defamatory, injurious, discreditable, uncomplimentary, depreciative. Okay, I'm comfortable. The language has not run off and left me. Corbett has health care. We should too. Quick as you figure out what's derogatory about that, do let me know. I have not seen a follow-up on this story, so I don't know if A.J. Marin is contesting the ticket. I hope to goodness A.J. Marin is. And I hope that somewhere there's a magistrate who will laugh this and the officer in question out of court. Perhaps with a little lecture about, don't ever let me see another ticket you've written with that kind of language on it in a case like this. Jesus. I mean, Corbett has health care, we should too, is about as derogatory of Tom Corbett as a water complaint in Murray County, Tennessee, is a terroristic threat. But you see, the Republicans have built themselves a nasty little crisis-laden social edifice whose chickens are coming home to roost. And they know it's messy and getting messier. The state of North Carolina, for instance, just screwed its citizens out of the ability to have money when they've lost their job. North Carolina is, I might remind us all, the fifth highest unemployed state in the union. And the Republican majority there seems hell-bent on seeing if they can't work their way up the ladder to maybe number one. It's getting uglier. It's getting scarier. And I don't see a lot of I don't see a lot of anything suggesting that there is a respite coming. And, of course, we've got some fun stuff this evening, too. But let's go to the phones. 304-658-3333 is the number. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
You know this is Dave.
Yes.
From Portland.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm well.
Oh, good, good.
Well, okay. It's a little muggy back here, but I'll make it.
Yeah, it's muggy over here, too. Gosh, it's not common that we have that kind of weather, but it's like 90 degrees and the humidity's pretty high.
Yeah, like walking through a sponge.
Yeah, well, not that bad. Not nearly as bad as it gets over in your parts, but it's bad enough. But, yeah, that was, I was enjoying your monologue there. I they're not fracking around here yet, but, people are really, I mean, that's scary stuff. I know they're doing it down in California. It's awful.
And even if you manage to, dodge the actual fracking, I'm sure they'll try to find some way to, drag places like Oregon and Washington into the mix. Maybe a giant liquid natural gas terminal for sending the stuff to China.
Yeah,
whatever.
Oh, yeah. Then the coal terminals also, they're trying to fight that, bring that in. But they're actually, you know, I made a new friend in the neighborhood here who's an activist, and he's fighting the privatization of water here because they want to privatize our water here and install all these plants to put stuff in the water or take stuff out of the water, or they're alleging that our water isn't clean, and people are fighting it like crazy because we have some of the cleanest water in the country here in Oregon. But, yeah, it's really, you know, I think all of this activism, they're really, really getting fed up with it, and it is getting kind of like the Adams administration, like you were saying. The governments get losing their patience with it, but people, it's good. I think it's really a good thing because people are getting madder and madder. They're getting hotter and hotter about things. And, you know, the last time we spoke, I think, you know, I was maybe sounding a little bit Christ-like, like, well, you got to try to understand people. But I think that this is going to be changing a lot of minds. I think a lot of people are coming down to their understanding what the hell is going on here, that they're all being screwed by the same forces, and it's an opportunity to for people to come together. Because I don't care what your nationality or your race or your political party or religion, you got to have water, right?
Last I checked, yes.
Yeah, I think so. And
the sake of clarity, Dave, post frack fluid is not water. That is toxic waste.
Oh yeah, it's a benzene, and it's all the toxic garbage that they have to pay to get rid of. They've found a way they can make a profit with it now, they're paying to get rid of it or paying to process it. But, I'm really of this opinion that we just have to rush to renewables and wean ourselves off this poison as quick as possible. All fossil fuels got to go. I was reading an article about in L.A., they're really, really ramping up their solar efforts down there. Remember we talked about Lancaster, or was it Palmdale, out north of the city, that people are expanding solar like crazy out there. But now they've got a feed-in tariff in L.A. County, and they're really starting to bring it in big time. But that's the only answer I can come up with is to do that. You know, fighting these people head on, it's like fighting a fighting dog. You're going to lose. You got to starve the beast. You know.
Well, there is some of that, Dave, but grassroots. I have to believe that grassroots action matters.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I'm not. I wouldn't belittle it a bit. As a matter of fact, grassroots action, and as far as getting people into solar and building up awareness and building up awareness of wind power, and all the answers for us are here above ground. We don't have to go to hell to.
Well, and I did see something encouraging earlier today, Dave. I saw a statistic that indicated that on a global basis, and I think this is incredibly important, on a global basis, renewable energy in its various forms, wind, solar, has closed in as the second greatest source of electricity on a worldwide basis. And in point of fact, it is realistic to think that it will overtake natural gas in probably within the next few years.
Imagine that. I thought I read something that the growth of the renewables had outstripped natural gas and coal, and there was actually more natural gas, more renewables now than natural gas and.
You know what, Dave? I said that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Renewables are closing in on natural gas for the number two position globally.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic.
They're number three right now. Coal is still way out front. So,
right.
Even though coal coal generally is less than 40% of the total electricity production in the United States, globally it is number one. Which means that the whole planet remains in a state of grave and increasing danger.
Yeah, every day that goes by, it's getting worse. But I think that people are waking up to that fact. I mean, you can't live through these heat waves without having to think. You know, starting to think about things. You know, I'm just feeling. Scared, but more positive. I mean, there seems like there's some rays of hope going on, at least. You know, a few years ago, I think I was more afraid. And did you happen to see that guy on Letterman, the one who got sent to jail? What's his name?
Oh, are you talking about the one who was sent to jail over the federal lands auction?
Yeah. I clicked on the link to the video of him on Letterman, and the guy sure was articulate and eloquent, and just really, really laid it down as concisely and well as possible. I was really, really impressed by what he said. He just said that, you know, you can't. We're going into a catastrophe. We can't stop it. We've got to prepare for it, and you know, having the people we have in charge now. Going to get pretty scary and ugly. It already is scary and ugly, but it's going to get worse. We've got to get rid of them. Get them out.
Yeah.
And that's changing. That's about changing minds, I think, because you know, they can redistrict until the cows come home, but I don't think it'll help in the end. People will see what they've got to do and pay that off to face the truth.
Well, as long as if they can actually vote.
Mm-hmm.
And make no mistake, they're gonna work these redistricting plans hand over fist and hammer and tongs, because it's the only thing that keeps them in power. Texas, one could argue, might likely turn completely blue in 2014. And the only way, as actual residents of Texas, like Sergi and Edward and Beth and Texas Betsy, have all pointed out, the only way that a Louis Gohmert manages to stay in office is if the system is itself gamed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that kind of stuff, sooner or later backfires. And people it's a rigged game. Elections here always have been in this country, unfortunately. But I think that there's a way of playing that back on the perpetrators too, because it, first of all, it fires people up, and it really makes people angry when you want to take away that kind of a basic right from people to vote. I mean, it's a basic right here in this country, and I just think that people are just coming down to brass tacks and facts, facing up to what's going on and what we got to do. I mean, these are acts of desperation by these people. You know, they're acts of desperation, and it can't go on. They won't be able to hold, even if they did win in the political process, which they seem to have been doing, even though they've been losing all the national elections, they've been able to buckle down a few states. I think things will change around those places, because people over there, they got to drink water too. I think the people in the Dakotas, they got to drink water. Everyone's got to drink water. If they, you know, call it what you want, call it terrorism, call it anything else you want, but if you raise your voice about the quality of your water, and everyone's got a right to water. That's a more basic right than almost anything else. Everything's got a right to water. For God's sakes. And
But the thing is, you, Dave, you and I are on the same page with that assertion. But there are people, and as it turns out, they are people with vast amounts of money, who do not see things like access to clean water the way you and I do. You know, the two-thirds of the Earth's surface is covered by water. But of that water, only 1% is fresh and useful for human hydration.
Right.
And that number is diminishing every day. You and I see access to water as one of those things that is an essential human right, because it is essential to anyone's ongoing attempt to continue being a human being, as opposed to, you know, turning back into the cycle of, you know, atoms, dust to dust, ashes to ashes, whatever. But like I said, there are people with vast and obscene amounts of money who do not share our position. They believe that, as is the case with everything else upon which they set their eye, that water is a source of profit for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
And unless it's kind of like what we were talking about last night with Miami. You know, 100 years is not a lot of time to plan for a massive crisis-based out-migration. And we are also short of time for planning or dealing with or planning to deal with what will ultimately be an assault on access to water. You say everyone has to drink water, but that comes with a caveat. Because once they manage to privatize it, I have to deal with privatized water coming out of my faucet. We used to have a well, and it used to be sweet and cold, but the coal industry ruined that and poisoned it. So now we get a water bill every month, and what we pay into our water bill services a company that services its larger holding company, that's owned by a holding company in the UK that is ultimately owned by a company with one of the worst environmental records in the entire world that is based in Germany.
What is that, Nestle?
It's the American Water System. I pay a bill to West Virginia American Water, West Virginia American Water is owned by American Water, and then the holding company in the UK, and then ultimately the company in Germany, whose name I don't know, I don't remember it right off the top of my head. But it doesn't go to making the water better. It doesn't go to preserving or protecting water supplies. I mean, the water that we drink out of our faucet is drawn from the New River, which is not all that far from ungodly amounts of toxicity.
Then is it purified?
And then it goes through a water treatment plant before it goes into the pipes and winds up in my faucets.
I see. Yeah, over here we have what we call Bull Run. There's a reserve up in the mountains up there, Mount Hood, and it's a snow melt rainwater runoff. It's a protected reserve, and it's like Portland's water. A lot of other parts of the state here in Oregon are suffering already, and like the Klamath Basin down in southern Oregon they're having lots of water battles, and their water battles breaking out all over the place. I don't think that the powers that be will be able to keep a lid on that, because it's like food. You know, when food gets to a certain price, to a certain level, and people can't afford food, and they're in subsistence living at that point, that's when things happen. That's when all hell breaks loose. And it's not me saying it; it's just the facts.
Well, I think something else happens before all hell breaks loose, and generally that is that people begin to suffer and die. And for instance, you know, even though it's a private water system, they are answerable, theoretically, here in the situation I'm dealing with, they're answerable to the Public Service Commission. So the Public Service Commission sets rates. But the Public Service Commission is primarily a rubber stamp for whatever any utility wants.
Right.
And if your water gets turned off for non-payment of bill, you can cry to the Public Service Commission until hell freezes over. They're not going to make anybody give you water back. I mean, if you get turned off and you can't pay the bill, it don't get turned back on.
Oh yeah, we're having
and there will come a day, I think, when you're going to see more and more and more of that. You know, look at the unemployment compensation system in the shenanigans in North Carolina. What do you do when your unemployment runs out, you're not making any money, and you've got a mortgage, and you've got a car payment, and you've got an electric bill and a gas bill and a water bill and a trash bill, and somewhere along the way you're thinking you might like to periodically eat food?
Yeah, well, you know what happens, you know what you do is you suffer, and when the suffering gets enough, when the outrage builds up enough, it's gonna break loose. It's just facts. And it's terrible, and there's going to be a lot of suffering. Obviously there has to be a certain amount of suffering.
But I mean, how do we, as committed and concerned and decent human beings, as opposed to Republicans and teabaggers and the like, how do we put something in place to take care of people that are being cast out and allowed to just, well, okay, I'm sorry, you can't pay your water bill, no water for you, tough shit. Right? How do you reach out to them? Do we just say, well, you know, hopefully you can go to the church, and maybe if you pray loud enough, they'll give you some money to pay your water bill? Well, what happens the next month when you still don't have a job and you still don't have any unemployment compensation and you still can't pay the bill?
You suffer. And like I say, the suffering has to get up to a certain point where people just say enough, and the outrage builds up enough. I that's close to the facts as I can get. Is people just got to be put in enough pain to take action. That's what pain is about. It's a message to our nervous system that action must be taken. And when it gets to that point where people don't have water, You'll see things change. Because everyone's got to have water. The cops got to drink water. Everyone's got to drink water. and they want to take that away. That's going to be whatever it takes to make change happen. That's what I'm for. And
then there's the overarching question of what happens when the water is toxic. I mean, this is for instance, the story out of Murray County, Tennessee, is not about somebody's well. It's about their public drinking water supply.
Right. No, but that's totally outrageous. That phone call that you played was entirely over the top outrageous. And anybody who hears that, I mean, I've seen that story for the last few days. It's still around, and it's an outrage. And there just has to be enough outrage, and there has to be, I've lived through these things where things just seem outrageous. Outrageous things going on. I was down in California when we had. Remember, I talked about the riots before in some of our calls. After the Rodney King trial, after the cops were acquitted, things just happened, and things got out of control for the people, the controllers. They lost control, and that's what had to happen. People had to wake up. And my anger was to a certain level where, I think that, that sometimes that just has to happen because these people are, they're sociopaths. They're sociopaths, and they're not thinking straight. They're not thinking in a mindset of cooperation. They're thinking about getting what they can for themselves. Well, that could only go on so long, Bob, till people just say enough. And when they don't say enough, they act out.
The things we're talking about, Dave, just fill my head with visions of a possible future. Can you imagine a future in which there is water banditry? In which one has to become an outlaw in order to provide water to one's family.
Well, I could imagine that, but I don't think that, what you're describing is a scenario that I don't think would really happen, because you're talking in terms of the framework that we're living within right now, surviving through that. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think the framework can survive something like that. I just don't. And things get to a certain point, Bob, where people just say, it's like you're putting the cart before the horse or closing the barn door after the horse left or something. I don't know. It's not going to work that. It's not going to go down that way. People are going to get outraged enough. And when you tell your stories about what's going on over there in West Virginia, that stuff's been going on for years and years and years, and it's slow and painful, and it's an isolated situation. But the same thing is happening everywhere to everyone now, and it's always been an outrage what's happening over there, but now it's going on coast to coast, and I think things are going to come to a head soon, because there's. A lot of these things that these idiots want to do are logistically impossible anyway. You can't take this acidic butylene or whatever the hell it is, the tar sands oil, you can't bring it down that far. It'll corrode the pipes that it's going through. You can't drill in the Arctic Ocean because it's just not possible. It's not possible. You can't frack in the middle of the desert because there's no water. I mean, these people are just out of their minds. They're idiots. And they're pushing people beyond the breaking point. It'll happen soon. I'm feeling more confident that it will happen, that the change will come. It's really sad that there's going to have to be, and that there is a lot of suffering going on now, and there will have to be in the future. But the suffering has to just get to a certain point. The outrage has to get to a certain point, I guess, for people to take action. So where it's always been,
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. I, I, I get occasionally I'll get emails from people in which they talk about the fact that, you know, Malthusianism is alive and well in the far and thin atmosphere reaches of the ultra 1%, in which the best thing that could possibly happen to them would be if a few million of us just, you know, a billion or so, just kind of died off. Maybe a couple of billion. And it's hard to look at these circumstances and not see it. I mean, when you say, Dave, there will have to be some suffering, that makes my skin crawl. Because no one that's listening to this program is entitled to think that they will not be the ones who do the suffering.
I'm very, very afraid of what's going to happen. And I know if they want to do away with most of us. People got to realize that. And when they wake up to that fact, it's like, have you ever been in a life and death situation where you had to take action? And you had people like to go into war. They're in life and death situations where it's either them or the person coming after them. And you wake up to reality at that point, I guess. I mean, I don't want to sound, you know, so clinical and cruel about all this, but I'm just trying to talk logically about it rather than, okay, let's, you know, whatever. It's just going to happen. It's going to happen. It's inevitable because that's what happens. And now these people get so to a point where they're so out of touch. They're so out of touch. They get in over their heads and then they get what's coming to them. That's just the laws of nature, I think. Pretty much. It's like, I know you love Dr. Seuss. It's like you're the turtle, you know? You get up to a certain point and then, then you fall. Then the little guy on the bottom sneezes and it's all over. You know?
Yeah.
That's pretty much, I love Dr. Seuss myself. I was raised on that stuff I like to talk to people that I disagree with a lot too, you know, and say, you know, hey, you know, what do you think is bringing this on? What do you think? I just ask them questions, you know. I won't argue with them ever. I play the kind of the mental jujitsu with them and ask them questions and leave them pondering because they're not doing enough thinking. If they think it's the liberals that's doing it to them, first of all, I don't think there are very many liberals in the government anymore. And second of all, they've got a lot more in common with you and me than they do with these people running the show. You know?
Sure. But
and that's kind of what has to happen. I think, you know, I'm an agnostic myself, but you know, if I was religious, I'd say right about now, you know, God's pretty pissed off at Oklahoma and Texas and a lot of these other places where those conservatives are the strongest and
well, right, and if homosexuality is the abomination, they love that word. It's an abomination.
Whatever.
Right. If it really is, well, I don't know. Was God out there helping some golfer win a golf tournament this past week when the DOMA ruling came down?
Give me a break. Yeah. Well. All I can say is, you know, over in Louis Gohmert's district, if and when the people finally wake up around there, those parts, I sure wouldn't want to be Louis, because it could get pretty ugly for him. He'd be in a tough spot down there. If he's in town, he's not up in Washington, you know, if and when people down there wake up, and I think they will, sooner or later they will, you know, it's going to get pretty bad for the people on top. And you know, historians and economists and anybody else who's in the know will tell you that. It can only get to a certain level, and, you know, maybe they've staved off revolution by a decade or so with iPods and iPads and whatever else to distract us, but the chickens are going to come home to roost sooner or later.
Well, you remind me of that that Native American proverb that goes something like, only when the last tree's been cut down, only when the last river's been poisoned, only when the last fish has been caught, only then will white people figure out that you can't eat money.
Right. Well, it's going to, it's,
but even that is a is dire in its own right, because when that moment of recognition comes, what good is it, Dave?
Right. Well, you know what?
It's the eternal question about what was the what was the guy, and we assume it was a guy. What was the guy thinking when he chopped down the last damn tree on Rapa Nui? What was that human being thinking when he chopped down the last tree in Chaco Canyon?
Pretty crazy, but I think that I don't think it's going to take that long. I think people are waking up right now. I think we're just going through an awakening, and it's hard to see the big picture when you're just a little guy like you and me on the ground. But I have a feeling that things are, there's a groundswell, and things are changing, and things are going to be vastly different 5 years from now. And maybe they'll be worse for a while, but that, I think on the other side they'll be better.
I'm not being disagreeable or anything. I'm just trying to figure out, Dave, who is going to be here to find out that things are better on the other side.
That's a good question. But
because
you know,
as someone who has 4 children and 3 grandchildren, or as President Obama likes to say, as the father of 2 daughters, only in my case it's 3 and 1 son. And those 3 grandkids, 2 little boys and one little girl, I cannot conceptualize. I cannot even allow my mind to go to that place where in 100 years' time they or their own offspring, which will be my progeny to one degree or another, will have to struggle for their very existence over seemingly simple things like water or shelter or air that they can breathe. You know, remember, there's a kind of order here. You can go about 40 days without eating. You can go but maybe 4 days without drinking water. Can't go 4 minutes without breathing air. And if the air you're breathing is poisonous, well, you understand the implications.
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, on that subject, I think that all hell may break loose sooner over in China than it's going to happen over here. I mean, people are running away from there now, and their people are being offered jobs, lucrative positions, and they refuse to go there because of what they're doing to their environment. And they're going to have to come down to, we're all going to have to face reality real soon, because whether or not we want to or not, it's reality is reality. Facts are facts. Air is air, and if there's no air, you die. Right? So, I get really angry about this stuff sometimes, but then I think about like that scene in The Godfather where Michael is talking about how, well, you know, if you can have a gun planted for me over there, I'll kill them both. I'll take care of it. Situation, and they all laugh and they said, "What are you going to do? What do you think you're going to do?" And he said, "Well, it's not personal. It's strictly business. And you know, business in these billionaires' minds is billions of dollars. Business is survival for most of us. That's our business. People got us. And if you to that point where you're spreading people's survival, the point it's." All hell's going to break loose, wherever and everywhere. And I have a lot of hope that and confidence, actually, that things will get straightened out. I think it's real sad that we have to go through this and we have to do this suffering when all the facts are out there, laid out there for us, you know? It's like the run-up to the Second World War. I mean, there should have been no doubt about what the plans were for what Hitler was planning to do. But he was similar to the Koch brothers or Tillerson or, you know, or Blankenship or any of these guys. You know, he was a megalomaniac, sociopathic freak. He was out of his mind. So, you know, you try to appease that crap and it doesn't work too well. Sooner or later, you have to face facts. And these people are, they have no imagination. They're idiots. They think they can just keep doing the same thing that they've been doing and more and more and more and more and more and more and more. And, you know, sooner or later, the chickens are going to come home to roost. Like I say, they get in over their heads and then they get what's coming to them. That's all there is to say. And, I don't know. We're living in interesting times. Living in really interesting times. Wouldn't you say?
That's the understatement of the year.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to getting to the other side. You know, it's.
I think if I may be so bold as to say this, Dave, I think it's more a matter. Rather than looking forward to getting to the other side of this crisis, let us instead say that we are looking forward to surviving to the other side, and that we are looking forward to trying to create the kind of communities that can survive to the other side.
Yeah, I feel real good about that. And I'm not a huge fan of Winston Churchill, but he said, I think he one line out of one of his speeches that I think is good is, let us brace ourselves for the task before us, because we have to get there. And we got to, there's certain things that we have to do. And just, you know, if you just think about it like, okay, we know the situation. I mean, you do a fantastic job of reporting the present situation. What do we have to do to make it, to change it? I think we have to change some people's minds. That's real hard for people sometimes. Sometimes they'll never change their minds. Sometimes they'll just have to, you know, fall by the wayside like nature intended. Other people, will fight. Eventually, we'll have to learn how to cooperate, or we're all done for, you know?
Yeah, and that's...
That's the way I see it.
And it's a question that entails and embodies the whole nature of being a human.
Absolutely.
Humans survived long enough to progress... You know, the earliest humans. At one point, there were less than 2,000 of us.
Amazing, isn't it?
And we didn't have big sharp teeth, and we couldn't outrun a cheetah, and we didn't have the strength of an elephant, or the night vision of a hyena, or the flight ability of a vulture. Even we had big brains. And we understood that in order to survive, and we understood it even, you know, it wasn't philosophical at that point. It was instinctual. And we understood that in order to survive, we had to cooperate. Well, we're not down to 2,000 yet. But we are at a place where if we do not cooperate, we will not survive.
I think it's like the progression of our whatever you call it, society, civilization. We have this kind of yin and yang of our psyche, which is competition and cooperation, and I think they both tie in very closely to the instinct for self-preservation. If you in fact have the instinct of self-preservation, at some point you have to cooperate. If you want to compete and be a predator, sooner or later, you know, it's like going from the hunter-gatherer to the farmer. It's like going from hunting and gathering fossil fuels to farming so- saw this video that I really loved. It was called Here Comes the Sun, and it's about the German solar industry and how they did it over there. And it was just really inspiring to me about how they were doing how they did it over there, and they're starting to do it over here. And it's like people can't compete forever. Sooner or later, they have to cooperate. We've got to cooperate. We've got to come together. And I think I just see good things in the future, but maybe some bad things between now and then. I don't know. But I'm less scared now, which is totally against, you know, what they want. We don't have a war on terror. We have a war of terror. I mean, if somebody's going to cut off your water supply, you'd probably be in terror, wouldn't you? You'd be pretty scared if you didn't have access to fresh water. It wouldn't take too long, like you said, to be at a point where you were desperate. And if you didn't get it...
Not very long at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, to call somebody who's complaining about their water quality a terrorist, that's outrageous. That's really, really outrageous. And anybody that hears that should be just completely outraged. Whatever their religion or their race or their political party or anything else, give me a break. We all got to have water. So,
yeah.
I've enjoyed our conversation, and I love calling you on Fridays because then I can listen to the rebroadcast over the weekend too. I missed calling last week. I had some stuff going on because I've got a few things happening. I may have found a job, which is a miracle, but it seems like things are picking up around here, around Portland, a little bit. The economy is picking up to some degree. And it'll really pick up. It'll start smoking if we have to go to renewables, which we do have to do to survive. If every house in Portland needs to have solar panels on, there's going to be a lot of jobs. And, you know, it's like I tell my buddies in the car business. So just imagine if we had to just junk all these gas cars and everyone had to get a new electric car. You know how many car deals there'd be. Just think about it. It'd be beautiful.
Well, yeah, it would.
It would. It will be. It's going to be as bad as it is now. It's going to be that good soon. Because I just think I think things are just getting to a point where people are just throwing up their hands, and it's coming down to realizing that the people in charge are incompetent, and.
I don't know how incompetent they are, Dave, because they seem to be getting everything they want. Now, they are benighted. Perhaps they are incapable of long vision, but they are quite competently stealing everything that's not nailed to the floor, and they're working on stealing the nails.
Sure. Well, Louis and Marie Antoinette did too until. They didn't. You know what I mean? They were doing pretty well. They were living Fast City, too, until things kind of changed.
Understood. Dave, you have yourself a wonderful weekend.
All right. We'll see you soon.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. Dave calling from Portland, and we will move onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Juanita.
Hey, Juanita. How are you?
Doing pretty good. How about you?
Like I said, a little warm around here. Kind of muggy, but, you know, we'll make it through.
Okay. Yeah, it's that way here in Columbus as well. And I talked to my aunt in Beckley last night, and she said it was, you know, she was a little bit uncomfortable. However, she doesn't like to leave the air conditioner on because she says, it gets cold at night, and then she wakes up, and she's in pain, so... trying to get her to regulate her air conditioner has been probably a 10-year ordeal. So, but anyway, Bob, yesterday you were talking about the the abortion issue, and I tried to call in, but you know, the thing that disturbs me about the whole thing is that men, they have a choice, Bob. And you know what that choice is?
Whether or not to, well, I mean, there's a couple of choices. You tell me.
Well, first and foremost, their choice is see ya. Once you tell them you're pregnant, they don't ever have to look at you again. They don't have to see the baby born. They don't have to do nothing. And good luck with child support. My brother has worked for child support for over 20 years. And their rate of collecting child support is very low. I remember years ago it was something like 15%. But basically, if you can't find them, you know, if you can't find the father, then, you know, most likely will not, things just won't work out. And, you know, the fellows don't have, they're not stigmatized. Nobody's going to call them an unwed mother, welfare mother, or she had an illegitimate baby, or even worse, bastard. And even single mother, if you say single father, that's, people think that's wonderful. But single mother has kind of a negative, you know.
Well, it certainly did when Rick Perry was flogging Wendy Davis with it.
Right. But, you know, and when you look at abortion, after abortion, once women got that bit of control of their body, then other things started to be taken seriously, like rape, for example, domestic violence. These things, you know, after Roe v. Wade was passed, we had some success, and it hasn't been that long ago, Bob. I mean, we're talking basically the 80s, you know, when they really started getting tough on domestic violence and sexual harassment. And probably Anita Hill with Clarence Thomas really did do, you know, I thought, well, she brought the... the emphasis on, to move it out where, you know, there was a really good debate on sexual harassment. But none of these things, I think, would be addressed if it wasn't for Roe v. Wade. And believe you me, if they take away that, other things will go away as well. And so, you know, I don't know. But I also wanted to say about Paula Deen, Bob. Did you read the lawsuit?
Yes.
Well, her brother, I mean, these people, Bob, these are the kind of people that showed up at the lynching with a picnic lunch. These are cruel people.
Well, that's why I said that. The thing that shocked me most was that self-admitted revelation out of her little autobiography, or her biography, or whatever, where she talked about reveling in smacking and breaking the blisters on a little black child's arms,
on her hands, and her and the black lady either slapped her or spanked her. And the father, Paula Deen's father, had her arrested.
Jesus.
Yeah. So, yeah, she had a bat, some type of bat, and she hit the girl's hands with the bat and bursted the blisters. And, you know, the mother was outraged and attempted to spank Paula. And, yeah, Paula's father had her arrested. But, of course, you could do that in those days. I mean, you could just walk up to an African American and slap them in the face, and there was nothing they could do about it, you know. So it's, you know, and then the what I can't stand is whenever we have, you know, these celebrities who make these type of outbursts or racist type of comments. If there is always an effort by the mainstream media to discount it. So what they do is they bring on all these apologists.
Right. They
and say that, well, she didn't mean it. Oh, she's really not racist, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, between two things, if we're going to compare them, the crass personal racism of somebody like Paula Deen can't hold a candle to the institutionalized racism inherent in the decision of the Supreme Court this past Tuesday with regard to the Voting Rights Act. One is far more dangerous and far more pernicious in its effect than the racism of some, you know, some nasty old lady who's trying to keep her multi-million-dollar empire alive.
Exactly. So I guess this week has been, you know, as far as the issue of race with the Supreme Court and, again, the second week of Paula Deen and the Trayvon Martin case, which I just can't watch on television because I can't stand the commentary.
Oh, Lord. I happened to cross headline news last night, and they had this obscene thing going on where you had five out-of-work trial lawyers, that's the way I think of these experts on TV, who were batting questions back and forth to each other like some sort of legalistic game of pepper out by the outfield fence.
Right.
And then they had a so-called jury who got to ask questions of the experts. And the whole thing, and I'm not trying to be shocking or nasty or anything, but I'm going to use a word here, Juanita. The whole thing struck me as masturbatory.
Yeah.
They were pleasuring themselves.
Of course.
While the voyeurs of whoever else was watching headline news, I guess, did the same.
Exactly.
And it just struck me as so unutterably nasty. I suppose there was a bit of novelty in it nearly 20 years ago when it was the O.J. trial and nothing had ever been covered that way before.
Right. And a lot of the ones that we see in the media now actually made their career from the O.J. Simpson trial. They had Nancy Grace and Jeffrey Toobin and I can't think of all, but it's quite a few that have made a career because of the O.J. Simpson trial. And, you know, the people who, you know, operate the media know that race, it's like porn. You know, it really is. I mean, and feminists have made the connection. I mean, feminists say that, you know, the consummate chauvinist is always the consummate misogynist. You know, it's the same kind of mindset. And so why not have, just as you have scantily clad women on television acting out racism, you know, it's one of those things as well. As a matter of fact, there's a program, and I've mentioned it on your show before, It's called Investigative Discovery. And what they do, they reenact crimes, you know, have the real, some of the real victims on, and they tell the story of the crime. However, what they do is they embellish the story with gratuitous sexuality, and you can bet on every show, well, I would say at least twice a week, you're going to see some black male terrorizing a white woman. I mean, it's
yeah, why not just start the Scary Black People channel?
Well, that's kind of what that is. And so, you know, it's what the media does. It perpetuates a lot of these stereotypes, and they stoke it for ratings. And, they are, given, well, I don't know. All I can say is I'll just wait for the verdict, which I just hope that there won't be. I hope they will do the right thing, but I'm not optimistic, you know. I'm not optimistic.
I don't think that, well, I think your response is about as rational as one could hope to have. There is no reason to be optimistic,
right,
under these circumstances.
And the young girl who testified,
oh, bless her heart.
I guess they were pretty brutal toward her on the internet about her size and the fact that she didn't speak clearly. But she was probably nervous. Look, I'm nervous right now. It's very hard for me to call in on shows like this because I'm very, very shy. And so I feel like, even though I'm talking to you, I feel like I'm, talking in outer space or something like that. And when I get nervous, I have a tendency to lose my train of thought and mispronounce words. So I can certainly understand, a young girl who's never testified in court before.
But I think the one thing she has going for her is she seemed very, at least to me, quite sincere.
Yeah.
And she didn't blush or back away at using, the real speech that they used.
Right. She didn't lie. I thought that was pretty wonderful, actually. But, Well, Bob, I guess that's about it, all I have to say. The thing with the voting, all I can say is, I don't know. Here in Ohio, as you know, it was horrible in 2000, 2004, and in 2008. But as long as I live, Bob, I will never forget 2004. I mean, it was awful here in Ohio.
Deliberately awful.
All brutal. My brother, when he told me when he voted and he pushed the name for Kerry, it popped back to Bush, And where I vote, when I pressed the button, it didn't do anything. And it was like the machine was set up like it somebody had already voted on it, And when you pushed the button, it didn't do anything. So, it was just, it was just horrible. That's all I can say. It's for the Supreme Court to have done Well, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. And I blame the Democrats for voting for Roberts and Alito.
Oh, yeah, and balls and strikes, and he'll be a jealous guardian of our religious liberty.
I remember some of
that. What good is religious liberty if you don't have any political liberty? And do you have any political liberty if your franchise has been compromised?
Right. And Clarence Thomas, to have replaced Thurgood Marshall with Clarence Thomas was such a slap in the face. But there is a Clarence Thomas probably in every courtroom in across America. I mean, here in Columbus, we had one that was in municipal court. He was brutal, specifically to African Americans. And so, yeah. You know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't know. So anyway, Bob, I'm going to hang up and listen to your other callers. And how's Agnes?
Oh, she's well. She's well.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Okay. So,
well, you have a wonderful weekend, Juanita. And by the way, Jeremy dropped a note just to say, tell Juanita she's absolutely right, and I'm rooting for her.
Well, good. Thank you. All right, then. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Juanita calling from Ohio. And let's see. It's about 17 minutes before the hour. My apologies to those of you who are in the chat room because I have... disappeared from it. For some reason, Java has decided to stop cooperating. So I'm going to do I don't know if I can ever get godforsaken Windows 8 to let me get to the shutdown and start and stop. Yeah, that thing pops up if you look at it, or just whenever you don't want to. It's one of the things I still hate about Windows 8. Ugh, yuck. But that, so I'm going to shut down and restart, but that doesn't mean I have to shut down the program. You might remember the beginning of the program, that blog post that I shared from Charlie Pierce's blog about the frustration of having your back written. Well, I've got a piece here from wearepowershift.org, and Jocelyn Sawyer, who is at Earlham College Reinvestment Campaign. And I think this is quite important. It says things that not a lot of folks have the courage to say. Jocelyn Sawyer writes, "When I tuned in to Obama's climate speech last Tuesday, I was expecting to hear a clear endorsement," and see if you can see the sort of nexus between Mr. Smith's comments about Texas and what Jocelyn Sawyer is getting at here. "When I tuned in to Obama's climate speech last Tuesday, I was expecting to hear a clear endorsement of the natural gas and nuclear power industries. What I heard was an enthusiastic endorsement of natural gas and nuclear. As someone who calls the shale fields home, fracking is an issue that is near and dear to my heart. I was obviously not happy with the president's words, but I had heard exactly what I had expected, and I was not surprised." Okay. She continues, "What was surprising and disappointing, however, was the slew of emails that flooded my inbox in the hours, emails from organizations that are leading voices in the environment movement, environmental movement. These messages praised Obama for his, quote, bold climate action, unquote, called his address, quote, the speech we've been waiting for, unquote, and hailed his policies as, quote, steps in the right direction, unquote. All over social media, these voices were holding up the positives of the speech while glossing over its dire implications for those of us who are facing fracked futures. Fracked futures. A number of words come to mind to describe my feelings upon reading these email blasts: hurt, saddened, outraged, insulted, and above all, disappointed. Granted, there were things to celebrate. While it may be too early to count Obama's shaky vow to reject the Keystone XL pipeline as a victory, that statement was at least a testimony to the power of the movement that has not allowed him to pass the pipeline quietly. Similarly, the allusion to the fossil fuel divestment movement, which some have been calling an endorsement, reflects the strength of our efforts on that front. But anyone who listened to the speech and missed the blatant endorsement of the natural gas industry, which was unarguably much stronger than any endorsement of student divestment, wasn't listening very closely. And if you read the official policy report, it was impossible to miss the clear intention to expand nuclear power. I understand that focusing on positive messaging is an organizing strategy. But as someone who has their home in the shale fields, the overwhelmingly positive response from groups that have claimed to be allied with the front lines made me feel worse than anything in the speech itself. Judging from my Facebook news feed and numerous face-to-face interactions over the past few days, I know that I'm far from the only frontline community member who feels that the big greens have thrown us under a bus. When you gloss over Obama's intention to support the destruction of our homelands, it is minimizing to our struggles and our resistance movements. And that's the moment you stop being an ally. So to those who are celebrating, I say, celebrate your victories, but do so with sensitivity and humility. A victory that leaves out people and communities is not a victory for everyone. There are those of us who are not rejoicing. Indeed, indeed. And I say again, I'm no single issue guy, but one issue is way up on my radar simply because I live with it every day. And I know that my friends, my neighbors, my colleagues, even the people with whom I don't agree, live with it every day. Denying that one is being poisoned does not influence whether or not the poison poisons one. Poisons work more thoroughly and relentlessly than does any propaganda. And the yay hoorays that came out over that speech well, they were cheers from people who don't live where either Jocelyn Sawyer or I live. Just don't. And mountaintop removal is, at present, limited to Appalachia, but you know, because you listen to this program, that it's on the move, it's on the march. You know the same blasting technologies are being used in places like Minnesota and Wisconsin for sand mining, and that the same ultra-fine airborne particulates are being breathed by infants, by mothers-to-be, by grandfathers, by every human being in the region. And when no mention is made of what is continuously being done to these communities, which are oftentimes communities where poverty is king, well, you know that that silence is more than just silence. It is, in fact, disdain. It is a marker an indication that if you live in a poisoned community, you don't matter. Straight up, you do not matter. And that's a hard thing to stomach. It's a hard thing to gather into your spirit. And it is something that hopefully one does not simply accept as a matter of course. A victory, she said it so well. A victory that leaves out people into communities is not a victory for everyone. And for the life of me, that sounds an awful lot like what Mr. Glenn Smith was saying when he said, "I'm truly sick of your celebrity obsession and your willingness to let Third World Texas fund your campaigns while people here suffer and die." That barb goes deep. True enough, Sparky pointing out, at least Obama didn't say clean coal technology. Oh, no, that would have had me screaming. That really, really screaming. So let's take a little break on this Friday on the front porch. You know the number, 304-658-3333. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. Either way is fine. And I'm awfully proud to say that we are $90 into July's fundraising. And that's a great head start. And thank you. Thank you very much, Irish Dave. Thank you, Kevin. And thank you, Sal. And a little note here from Anthropogene in the chat room. She's one of the ones that helped us get done with June. And thank you, Patrick, as well. She said, I do enjoy listening to the show and feel solidarity in the fight against big coal as they have descended upon our state, Washington, and we are fighting them all the way. I'm an owner-operator of a co-op coffee and bookshop in Everett, Washington, where we educate the public on such issues. Check us out on Facebook, Firewheel Community Coffee House. I'm going to go find them and friend them. I love your passion for women's issues, too. I was shocked when I first learned about mountaintop removal, and still can't believe it's legal. Then the bastards descended upon us, and we have been fighting like hell since. Our local Democratic representative here has taken $20,000 in Coke money, and of course is all for the coal trains, he says, for the jobs. We are betrayed by both parties. It's up to us. Anthropogene says, I will spread the word about the show and your cause. And remember, Bob, take no shit. Ever. Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Gene. So, yeah, a little break, and then your calls. This is Conversation Radio, Friday on the Front Porch, and a lovely Friday it is. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Head-On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yes, sirree. Hour number three, Friday on the front porch. And we will go straight away to the phones.
Hello?
Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. This is Jim again from Covington, Louisiana.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Yeah, I talked to you in like a week or so ago, a couple of weeks, Jim. But, yeah, it's just, you know, Obama's speech and just the whole environmental thing. And it's like, you don't have to be a genius to realize that, you know, that there's only so much the planet to go around. It's just like with the American buffalo. The white man came and killed them all off just about, then they pulled back. But it just, it seems to be something to do with, you know, is it a racial thing? Would the Europeans just have to destroy everything?
It's, well, I don't think we can necessarily go there, but it is a mindset, and it is a mindset that we have that white Europeans have used to certainly infect the rest of the world, and it's a mindset that comes out of the capital structure of monarchies, and capitalism itself, which was a sort of response to the mercantilism that existed under the English monarchy and was observable in the others. And it is absolutely at odds with the conceptualizations of life on this planet as many other peoples have experienced it. And for some reason or another, it also turns out to be terminal.
Yeah, and then religion, I mean, particularly the white man, you know, Christianity, but it seems to go perpetuate the myth of this, you know, afterlife where you're hanging out with the sky spook and everything's going to be really great. And then also that's a great way to get you to, you know, go ahead and just waste your whole life, not waste your life. Well, I guess, yeah, waste your life right to a sky spook waiting for this never to come nirvana or heaven. And even heaven doesn't sound that good to me, you know. From what they say, I don't want Bible verses and stuff. I don't know if hanging out with Jesus would be all it's cracked up to be.
Well, I think you've got to, you know what a fan of Mark Twain I am. I love to back periodically and read a piece of his called An Account of Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven.
I'll have to check that out.
Oh, it's really worth your time. It's, you can read it for free online. And there's a passage in there where he says, well, you know, they handed me my harp and my robe, and I was later told that, you know, most people sit around singing Hosanna and harping for a day or so, and it gets old pretty quick.
So,
hanging out on a cloud, plucking a harp, no, I'll take a pass.
Well, I mean, I've watched those preachers, you know, I've seen just about, you know, I'm a little old now, 53, I guess. And, I mean, I'm basically in the same time frame as you. You know, I remember, what was it, the 80s with the TPL Club, and that's when Pat Robinson was getting to the heyday. And then the sad thing about that is, I mean, that's a political force in this country, which, you know, I mean, makes me wonder about, you know, a lot of the American people.
You can very easily spend a great deal of time just scratching your head in this country.
I've got it in my family, man. I mean, well, yeah. I guess as you get closer to the end, the more, you know, some people get, the more they start looking forward to that, you know, playing the harp for, you know, it's like even with the Islamic religion, with the 72 virgins, if that's going to be eternity, I don't want 72. I want a lot more than 72, you know?
Yeah. And I'm not so sure I want the virgins, really?
Yeah, I want them to know what they're doing. I want Xavier Hollander or something.
Yeah, and I've said a million times before, who wants to go to a paradise that's inhabited by Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell?
Yeah. Jesus, and Pete, yeah. That's Billy Graham, did he just die? Is he still
alive? He's still on the mortal coil. He hasn't done his shuffling yet.
Yeah. Well, it'd be like everybody else at the funeral, all dressed up and nowhere to go. Oh, Bob, have you ever heard of the Church of the Subgenius?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and that because I was, Bob Dobbs and
Devo were great devotees of the Church of the Subgenius at one point, were they not?
Yeah, I found out. I used to have a friend who used to do a radio show in Florida at the Tulane WQL radio station, and he did a show, and that's how I tripped across that, unintended, and that basically, that's basically religion. I mean, you can start a religion on anything, and it's just about every religion seems to be that way. And, all right, Bob, I'm going to let you go. I can't.
All right, well, you have yourself a great weekend. Try to stay cool, and hopefully we will be talking soon. Anytime the spirit moves you, as they say.
All right, as Bob Dodge would say, yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. You take care. Bye now. And thanks going out to Marty helping us get started with July's fundraising. It's kind of nice to be ahead for at least a few days, for maybe a few hours, but it's nice to be ahead. Thank you. Thank you very much. So about 9 minutes past the hour, and if you want to get in the conversation, jump right in. Let's go to the Skype line where Sandra's waiting. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Bob, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're great.
All right. Yeah, I suppose it's you said that this connection for some reason worked pretty well last time, right?
Oh, you were getting big kudos.
Oh, right, yeah.
Your audio is pretty awesome.
That's it's a bit random because it really isn't anything special. But I just thought I'd check in because out here west, they're talking about, temperatures may break, I guess, in Death Valley, the hottest temperature ever recorded on Earth, which was 134 degrees.
Good
in
God.
In 1903 or something. But, they said that this stuck jet stream heat dome may challenge that. And it's, it's quite disturbing because that's starting to get to temperatures where, you really can't survive for very long. But, 122 in Phoenix for like days on end is what they're predicting. 122, 123. What's the damn difference between those two numbers?
I don't know.
It's 100. It's 103 in Sacramento right now.
You're a kid.
And that should be that way for the next 5 or 6 days, up to 106. I saw. So.
That's killing heat too.
Yeah, no, it is. And, in Las Vegas, they're talking, successive 110 plus days. So, this is a pretty nasty, heat wave here, all inspired by these meandering jet streams that's, a lot of climatologists are now attributing to the massive sea ice loss from 2007. To this day, so we're just in a world. We're in some deep doo doo here. This shit is outrageous.
Well, I think we are, and that's that was the nature of my conversation with Dave. Is And it goes back, Sandra, to Jeff Goodell's article in Rolling Stone, you know, Goodbye Miami.
Oh, well, yeah, that article was like, yeah, I read that and tweeted that one out and just thought, yeah, that's pretty disturbing, but...
and the question I keep asking, Sandra, is, you know, can you plan for a massive crisis-induced out-migration? Is 100 years enough time to plan? And if it's enough time to plan, doesn't that require that people actually begin doing something about it?
In fact,
Goodell points out that Tallahassee, the capital of Florida, is practically a shrine to climate science denial.
Yeah, no. I mean, and the thing is, it's the way that article was laid out was, you know, just sort of explained the unique tragedy of Miami, too. You know, it's not just lowlands. I mean, it's a whole bunch of other factors and, like, you know, how it was created artificially from the beginning. It's just going to be its ultimate demise, you know, because a lot of Florida was, it was created by people.
Well, yeah, I mean, go back.
You know, back to the early 1800s, I guess.
It's worth remembering that the first Spanish explorers who set foot there set foot right back off real quick.
Right. I mean, it just was, you know, it just not very hospitable. But the thing that was disturbing me, and which is disturbing across the board, is, you know, I can't remember, what was the guy's name? You were talking to?
Oh, Dave from Portland?
Well, he's talking about people have to suffer. No, the suffering is, he's talking as if it's some way of coming back from it. I'm confused because the type of stuff that's going down is not suffering. It's more elimination.
Well, yes, and that's why I kept querying what does the aftermath look like? Because, you know, one of those messages that we've messed up so badly, Sandra, is that these folks who say, you know, we're trying to save the planet. BS. You know, the planet's going to be okay.
Well, no, it'll be fine. I mean, I was just reading an article in either Science or Nature or something. They were talking about, you know, this lake where they drilled, you know, cores 1,000 feet down or some godly number down, and, you know, talking about what the earth was like, you know, when it was super duper hot. I mean, let's be clear, the earth will just burp us up and just move on.
Yeah, and
I mean, it will be here. You know, the sun has another 5 billion years or so to go. So, I mean, I don't know, people are so myopic. We're just talking about trying to maintain a climate that you can grow food to feed people. That's what's at risk, along with a host of other potential problems. But if all the arable land dries out and the water goes away, well, that's kind of, humans are in trouble, right?
Right. We are talking essentially about the ability of human beings to continue to live on the planet. We're not talking about the ability of cockroaches or anybody else, but humans.
But 140, you know, the sort of temperatures they're talking about in Australia, you know, half a century from now, those temperatures, they're not, you can't live. You can't be in air conditioning if it's 135 in Sydney all the time. It's just not going to work. I've been to Sydney, and it gets hot, but if it's like the kind of temperature they're projecting, that's not going to work.
No. It's especially not going to work with a continuously burgeoning population.
Well, at any rate, I just was, you know, it just struck me because I was just reading, you know, and was trying to run around like a chook without a head earlier so I can get my stuff done because I was thinking, oh, my God. 103, 104, 106, you know, who wants to be out in that? And, you know, my little dog Poppy thought, oh, I need to go out, I need to go out. I'm like, yeah, kick your ass out. before I could, you know, I'm looking and there he is right back. So that always tells me.
Yeah, he knew too.
Yes. So it's not very, you know, I don't know.
I remember my little sojourn a couple of years ago out to Las Vegas and standing out there in 114 in July. And all my life I've heard, yeah, it's hot, but it's a dry heat. Well, I'm standing there, and granted, I'm prone to perspiration, and I would perspire, and it would immediately evaporate, which was a neat phenomenon until you realize that that means that the human function of perspiration, which is meant to cool your body, is kind of being defeated even as it's happening. And then I realized, dry heat, schmy heat, it's heat. Now, I mean, it could, if you're in Alabama or even here where the humidity's gone through the roof, it's miserable. But dry heat versus wet heat, it's still heat. And it's still dangerous. And it ain't going away. I mean, is there any reason to think that that this is some sort of freak occurrence with the jet stream, that the jet stream's going to go back and behave itself?
Well, it seems to, yeah, I don't, you know, it seems to be a bit of a scary situation that's developing, where these weather systems are like, because this particular jet stream has been locked in place since winter. You see, we're talking.
Yeah, it's parked.
Stuck. And, you know, that's not, obviously, it's not good, because I don't know. I'm still tripping on the satellite images of those fires in the tundra. I don't know why I keep coming back to that, but that's just doing my head in. I'm like, that just sounds crazy.
Well, and factor into this, you know, because we don't know what all the relationships are. Factor in, say, one good Krakatoa-sized eruption somewhere.
Well, there's all sorts of volcano activity going on too, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the one in Mexico, I saw some images of that. That looks to be dubious. There's one in the Philippines that's sort of acting up. And I suppose there's only so much you can say, but the extremeness of it is just over the top. And I guess,
you know, that's why Jocelyn Sawyer's blog that I read just a couple of minutes ago about the great big important bold step forward environmental speech. I think it's important that kind of stuff gets out there, because it's one thing to have a nice salary in Washington, D.C., and say huzzah for an address that lionizes the fracking industry. It's another thing to live where they're fracking.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's funny how nobody really his speech didn't get that much coverage, right? But, you know, there's some items in that speech. Once again, it's kind of, you know, Obama is so good with the rhetoric. I mean, hence the, I couldn't believe the vestment came out the man's mouth. I'm like, damn. So he hits all the right notes, because to me that was a big deal that he said divestment. But it also is yet another example of, you know, Obama grabbing the rhetoric. Like, he jumps in front of the parade, but that's all he does. There's no follow-up. And so I'm not, you know, it's hard for me to sort of get with that program, because he embraces the nuclear and the natural gas so heavily, along with, I don't know if you caught this, but he's talking about also, you know, with the new global trade arrangement with sustainable products. Come on now. Anytime you're talking about international trade and sustainability, I mean, that just sounds a bit special too. I was a bit put off by that, because trade agreements never seem to bode well for something like that. But I could be wrong.
Well, but I don't think you are. See. Because again, underpinning all of that is an urge toward not the salvation of humanity's ability to live on the planet, but instead the urge to make a profit.
And it's not like Obama was talking about the Clear Act. You know, I mean, no one talks about the Clear Act, which is a bill. I think it was introduced in 2011, but it's a dividend, the sort of cap and dividend, which sends money directly to the public, and it could be implemented pretty much straight away, but obviously it would work too well, and it would crowd out the fossil fuel people, so it won't get done. But the point I'm trying to make is that there are things out there that, if it was sort of like a Manhattan Project type mentality, could get rolled out today.
Yeah, and probably create the googly crazy numbers of jobs. I mean,
right.
I remember back
in
the early aughts when some groups were pushing what was called the it was like a 21st century Apollo project that was all about mass transit and building passenger rail and doing so greenly and well, we saw what happened to that. You know, look what Scott Walker did. Jesus, he cost Wisconsin jobs because he didn't want no damn railroad running through Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah,
it was going to be a Kenyan socialist, you know, railroad.
Well, I mean, but see, you know, it's if we're entering if we're also looking at this sort of climate catastrophe at the same time as entering this new era of state equal sovereignty hell. I mean, we're just in deep doo-doo because states' rights ain't gonna get nothing done that we need to get done.
Right. What century do you expect the Republican House to take up Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, Sandy?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just some sort of joke. And, it's terribly frightening because... at the risk of sounding hyperbolic, I'm like thinking when the feds pulled out during Reconstruction.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm liking it to that kind of mentality because there you can use the third part three to trigger and take these people to court, but you have to pay for it. And you no longer have the backing of the feds. So if they wanted to implement that, say, that Louisiana literacy test, who's stopping them, Bob?
Well, now there's nothing to stop them.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, because people might say, oh, no, Sandra, you tripping. You know, how can that be? But then I keep thinking of Rep. Lewis talking about what was going on in the 1870s when you were electing all sorts of black people and black people were voting, and then oopsie, it was snatched away and we had almost 100 years of apartheid.
Jim Crow, exactly.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, it went backwards. So I don't think it's a far stretch to think that we're going to see some really outrageous attack on the franchise coming up right now.
Oh, I think they've already started. There were two redistricting plans that went into motion almost before Chief Justice Roger Taney Roberts got done reading.
Yeah, but the whole, I mean, the idea of making, you know, all states this equal sovereignty BS, the implications are sort of stunning. Because there's endless programs that are dependent on the superiority of the federal law. And if all the Supreme Court is doing is chipping away at that, you know, we're also in just a world of trouble coming up. Because John Roberts is 58.
Yeah, he's going to be there for another 40 years.
I know he has epilepsy. Yeah, I don't care, you know, unless something happens.
Right, right.
See, he fell over a couple of years back. I was like, please don't get up. And I don't care, because he's the enemy.
Well, as Pierce noted a couple of days ago, it may have been 100 years since there was an asshole quite like Sam Alito on the court.
Well, he's a horrible. Well, no, I remember when he was up to get on the court. The one story that stood out was like, yeah, if you want to shoot some 15-year-old in the back running. That's fine. And it just went downhill from there with that guy. He's a horror show.
Oh, yeah. And just to go back to Obama's speech for a minute, there was a, there was a telling little moment, I remember I ran and grabbed the transcript. And it's this paragraph where he says, "In my State of the Union address, I urged Congress to come up with a bipartisan market-based solution," there we go again, "to climate change like the one that Republican and Democratic senators worked on together a few years ago. And I still want to see that happen. I'm willing to work with anyone to make that happen." And when you see it on the printed page, you can almost hear the crickets. Or you know, Bueller. Because, I mean, it ain't going to happen, Sandra. It just ain't going to happen.
Well, let me ask you something since you're looking at that. Am I tripping? But I thought the State Department already said that it is in the Keystone is in our national interest and it will have a minimal emissions impact. I thought they already said that. What is he talking about?
I honestly don't know because that was the first thing that came to mind when I heard it.
Okay, so I'm not tripping. That just sounded a bit funky, right? And weird.
Well, it sounded to me like, you know, a little wave, you know, the little bit of the lodge high sign to the boys who want to go and place their bets early. Because, you know,
I don't understand.
Ship sailed.
I know, but why would he say that knowing that anybody who's invested or interested in this project knows that already? Because I'm thinking, what was he talking about? I mean, is he thinking that people aren't paying attention, or what is he doing with that statement? I just thought it was really cynical, or I don't know what's going on.
Well, he was trying to bank the fires of the people that are opposing Keystone XL.
Well, because XL would be, it would already be go if it wasn't for this pushback on him, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
But remember, there's a bunch of allegedly Democratic allies out there that still want this damn thing built. And I think the political calculus, Sandra, is that he's trying to figure out which side he can screw over, because he's going to have to screw one of them.
No, but it's funny how nature isn't cooperating because, I mean, you know, God bless those people in Calgary, but damn, the timing of that was a bit special, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like, you know, even the highway that was just went from a highway was called the Trans-Canada Highway.
Yeah.
Which was a river.
Yeah, I saw that video and it was, and somebody, somebody down, you know, down comment said, can anybody tell me where this is happening? I mean, was that a stream that used to be a stream and now it's, and they said, no, that's the Trans-Canada Highway.
Right. And I was just like, OMG on that. But the thing is, apparently the power to all of that could be out for months.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the oil cap, I mean, it's the oil capital of the world. And, you know, it begs the question, well, what is powering, you know what I'm saying? What's going on there with all their extractions?
Right, and you have to wonder what all of that water did. I mean, did any of that get anywhere near the moonscape that is the tar sands area? What happens when that crap gets washed downstream? Who gets poisoned? Who dies?
They already showed, you can already see a satellite image of a brown washing up near some part of the Arctic. So, I mean, you know, it's a huge amount of flood water.
Dear God.
That, you know, so it's just...
And might some of that be ice still? I mean, under different circumstances, if we hadn't melted the Arctic ice cap... Might some of that water have still been, you know, ice?
I guess. I mean, I just was looking at the satellite image. I thought, oh, my God, it is. And it was just they showed what it looked like before. And then you saw literally brown, which was the runoff from that disaster. And you're like, oh, my God. So,
well, you got. But anyway, I was going to say, you got a note in from Darlene. I think you'll appreciate this, Sandra. She says, Sandra noting that Obama is great on the rhetoric, but there's no follow-through, and we see his actions in conflict with his rhetoric. Isn't this a prime example, Darlene asks, of what a group of African-American women observed when they met with Obama after he'd been first elected? They walked out of that meeting and stated that he has no moral center.
Well, Shirley Sherrod, remember she said, oh, no, I don't really think he understands the sort of racism that basically African-Americans who are descendant from slaves. I mean, you know, I know she wasn't trying to be totally insulting, but I was like, ooh, snap on that one. So, you know, because she's a well-spoken, polite lady, but she really said something there that was very telling. I thought, oh, my God. So, you know, so I don't, you know, I don't really know, I guess we can refer to him as a bit of an empty suit.
that's the phrase that Kate likes to use.
Yeah, well,
and she's, and to Kate's credit, she's been hollering it since about, 2006. So.
Well, you know, I mean, the other day he could only rustle up some commentary about human rights when he was at the, you know, the place where they sent slaves to do the Middle Passage. I forget what that area, that room was called. Anyway,
there's a recreation of that down at the Museum of African American Enslavement in Selma, Alabama, and it's creepy to even contemplate. It reminds me of Venice's Bridge of Sighs. You know what I mean?
Mm.
It has the same emotional impact. But you know, there was that moment when he did rustle up a human rights remark, because he was in a country where they execute people for being gay, and the president of that country came right back at him and said, "Hey, listen, you might want to just leave that alone for a little bit, because this is a country that eliminated capital punishment eons ago. You're still killing people."
Was this in Senegal?
Yeah, I think so.
Shut up. Well, not only that, but a lot of, you know, people who have something invested in what's going on in Africa are like, well, when the Chinese premier came, or whoever from China, they bought $20 billion, $10 billion, $15 billion in infrastructure money. And, you know, Obama is just getting in the way of our getting ready to mourn Mandela. I was like, damn. You know what I mean? They were like, he picked a really bad time to turn up, they're saying. And we just want to, you know, be left alone to deal with the possible loss of
Mandela.
Yeah,
the timing of all that is the luck of a guy who draws ace, king, queen, jack, six. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I just thought that, you know, it's kind of because you're there interrupting this and you're not bringing any investment money, so...
Yeah, that...
you know?
Right. The days of... And for some reason, when he went over there, I was thinking about how... you remember all the noise that was made back in the 90s when Bill Clinton went to Africa and what popped into my mind is, well, I guess the days of people walking 30 miles barefoot over dirt roads to see an American president are probably long gone now.
Well, not only that, but people are hella bitching about what the security madness is doing to their daily commute or them just trying to get the hell on. That was another article I was reading.
Well, and and that applies even up in Berlin. I didn't realize it until I read subsequently, but that speech that he gave on a blazing hot Berlin day, which is supposed to be a bit of an anomaly, blazing hot in Berlin. You know, he gave it in front of the Brandenburg Gate, and where he had gone to Germany once before and was met by, you know, teeming throngs of people cheering him on, it was this speech was given to a hand-picked audience largely from the American school, and it was invitation only and incredible security and, you know, none of that reaching out to the people, ich bin ein Berliner business.
All right. Well, I just was, you know, it sounds like the security business for this trip is way over the top. But
well, the security business is always way over the top for any empire, wouldn't you say, Sandra? I mean, remember when the story came out under Dim Leader? I forget, he was visiting in some Eastern European nation or something, and we found out that the Secret Service were actually collecting the presidential poo. For fear that it would be analyzed and we'd find out how many mood-altering substances it took just to get George Bush out of bed in the morning.
Oh, I know. I don't want to go Sarah Palin, though, about Obama, so I'll just leave it.
Well, you know, hey, there's always Aaron Hernandez.
that looks to be...
That's disturbing. Getting creepier and creepier. Now he's being investigated in connection to two Boston murders in 2012?
Yeah, so he just is turning into, some sort of mass-murdering football player?
Right. What would the title of the memoir by Tom Brady be? I was in the huddle with a serial killer?
Yeah. I mean, but then again, I'm always like, well, I mean, that sport is so, it's a bit violent and frightening, so... why is everyone so shocked by it all? I mean, this guy sounded like he was playing with guns in college too.
Yeah, and there's that lawsuit down in Florida from the guy whose face he shot. He shot the guy's eye out.
That's right. You know, so it's like okay, well now he's looking at life or whatever goes on. He's through, but I mean, how many people are they gonna dig up that he killed?
Do you know what his signing bonus was with the Pats?
Was it like $12 million or something?
The overall contract was $40 million over 5 years. The upfront signing bonus was $12.5 million.
Right. So he has that money now, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess he'll need it for his lawyers.
Good God. Well, I'm sure this one will be on, this one will be on TV too.
Anyway, listen, I should go, but I need to tell you, you were talking about the chalk. You know about the one in San Diego, right?
Well, I saw your tweet, but no, I don't.
Okay, well, this guy wrote some messages in front of Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and some higher up was upset, and so the police arrested this dude, and they charged him with 13 counts of vandalism. He could get 13 years, and now it's gone to trial, and the judge has issued some sort of gag order.
Oh, for God's sakes.
I mean, you should look into it, because it's really, I mean, we're talking 13 years they're trying to send this man away for using chalk.
For chalk, yeah.
For chalk.
What, subversion by chalk?
Yeah, and it's San Diego, and, it's just kind of, it's just over the top. I mean, hopefully... something will give, because it's sort of police statey, to say the least.
Well, and it's weird and frightening all over this country. I just saw a story a few minutes ago. If for people who live anywhere near West Cliff, Colorado, you might want to take a pass on the July 4th parade, because the teabaggers are bringing their guns.
Shit, that's going to be the Texas legislature next week, right? They're going to be having their guns for sure this time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a retrograde motion in operation in this country that is just stunning to behold, Sandra.
Well, there are a lot of people who are getting upset, though. I'll agree to that, but I think it's going to be a pretty full-on summer. Anyway, listen, you have a good weekend.
Hey, you too, and stay out of the heat. Bye now.
Bye.
Sandra calling from the Sacramento area. 106 in Sacramento? Nah, it's okay. It's typical. That's to be expected. It's always like that, right? No. The Southern Colorado Patriots Club is telling its members to come to the West Cliff 4th of July parade and bring their unloaded rifles, especially the evil black ones. You know, the AR-15s. The Denver Post is reporting that this issue has polarized the West Cliff community in the space of a week. Yeesh. Well, this is just an outgrowth of, what was his name? Alex Karras? No. David Cor- Adam Kokesh. This is probably an outgrowth of his demand that his original plan to march on the Capitol on the 4th of July with loaded guns all the way through Washington, D.C., he then said, we're going to change it, and everybody's going to march on their state capitals or march somewhere. Just make sure you bring a gun. Jeebus. Lord God, Billy Bob. Note coming in from Robert in Sydney about Sydney last summer. It's a clever play on suddenly last summer. Sydney last summer. Bob, we had 2 days of 110 degrees Fahrenheit here in Sydney this past January, our summer. Going outside was like stepping into an oven. A week or two of temperatures like that would not be good. Meanwhile, it's been 55 degrees Fahrenheit, overcast and raining for about the last 3 weeks, even for winter in Sydney. It's a bit much. So it's about 18 minutes before the hour, wrapping up this Friday on the front porch, and to the phones we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
And how are you this evening?
Oh, I'm okay, Jim, I guess. How about you?
I've heard you use some terms that I've used before, like burgeoning, retrograde.
Yeah, they do come in handy.
Yes, they do, and they are accurate.
This is if you spend any time at all looking, because, you know, from day to day, it doesn't seem like anything's changing. You have to take a step back, I guess, Jim, and see that stuff really has changed.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the reason I sent you an email earlier saying that this planet simply can't support humanity as it increases. Simply can't.
Well, okay. I think it's pretty obvious that we're past carrying capacity now, because we are already at a place where in order for a certain segment of the population to survive, it is necessary that a significant segment of the world population suffer and die. I mean, that's what famine, that's what plague, that's what desertification is.
Well, Bob, man is his own worst enemy, whether it's in an active or a passive sense. And I think that's axiomatic.
Well, it's the curse, you know, those big, when we use our big primate brains to work together for the common survival of the group, the tribe, whatever.
Well, you know, remember that movie Forbidden Planet came out in 1957 with Walt?
Oh, sure.
Well, you know what happened to the Krell?
Yeah.
Sort of the same kind of thing, isn't it? Their own id destroy them.
Yeah.
I mean, their own, you know, basic thing is defined by Freud, destroy those people or those entities on a very...
And it was a parable. It was a parable for humans.
Exactly. And it's one that was not lost upon me when I saw it at the age of 11 years old.
Back then, I think the overtone was more in the way of, the threat of nuclear warfare. But that's the neat thing about a parable. It develops its own meaning over time.
Well, you know, that's what it meant to me. I didn't think of nuclear warfare at the time. I just thought of so many other things. Greed, avarice, many other things that are just as deadly and just as destructive as any atomic weapon could ever be. You know, it's kind of like our own psychological or psychiatric neutron bomb.
Yeah, yeah. And elements of denial, elements of paranoia, elements of fear. You know, those are all lizard brain functions, aren't they?
Well,
that seems to be what motivates a whole big segment of the population of this country these days.
Well, I mean, you know, look at buffaloes going over that horrible engraving I've seen from time to time of of buffaloes going over the edge of a cliff, you know, that type thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what I was thinking. You know, I'm just sitting here musing, preparing dinner, and listening to Sandra. She made a lot of good points tonight. I applaud her for it.
Well, you know, I she did indeed. And it's hard to look at these stories and not be just a little bit horrified, if not outright scared. I got to thinking last night after reading the Goodbye Miami article about something you and I had talked about before, and that is, you know, the potential supervolcano that sits out there in Yellowstone.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when she mentioned volcano. That would really be the chef d'oeuvre. That would be the big daddy of all of them, because that would split this country right in two.
And, you know, we're struggling to cope with tornadoes.
Yeah, we are.
And we've got and we've, you know, the fact that there are senators who say that, you know, I'm not going to vote for relief for this tornado until you tell me who's going to go hungry to pay for it. What in the, I mean, isn't that a little Burma shave sign on the side of the road that says, you know?
I know what you're saying exactly, and you know, I don't give a shit. I don't care. I mean, basically, they are up there filling their own rice bowls in their forbidden city. What can I tell you? But to get away from all that, what are you going to do for the 4th?
I don't know yet. I've usually made a little tradition of standing on the front porch and reading the Declaration of Independence in its entirety. I know we'll do that. We'll probably check the manager's specials over at Kroger's and see if maybe there's a pork butt or a little rack of ribs or something, and throw that on the smoker. And hopefully just relax a little bit.
You stand on the front porch and read the Declaration of Independence?
Yes.
Are there people listening to you?
Used to be my children.
Okay. Anybody else?
We've had neighbors from time to time, but sometimes I just do it for me.
Well, hell, you know, anything that's therapeutic. I mean, you know, hell, what if it works, do it.
I wish I had a Ben Franklin costume or something, you know, something to compete with the teabaggers, but
well, you could
it always, ain't in the budget.
You could always dress, you know, get a bed sheet and be Columbia Jim of the Ocean, or get Agnes to make you some spikes and you could be the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, but see, you get the bed sheets out around here and people get the wrong idea.
Listen, what are you telling me? They'd love it. If you got the bed sheets around...
Well, yeah, for them it'd be the right idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's the reason I said, you know, I sent you an email the other night. I said, aren't you scared of some of these people that you live around? Because apparently from what you said, some of them are pretty scary.
Yeah, but they're scary everywhere.
No, but I know, but particularly in this area of the country, I mean, God almighty, it is. They are scary. And it's just...
You do know the neighborhood, don't you?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, I make it a point not to know the neighborhood and just retreat within my own little...
Shangri-La?
Well, whatever you want to call it, that's what I've done, because... you know, each person has his own means of surviving until he doesn't survive anymore. And that's just the way it is. And then, you know, for me, that's become axiomatic. Unfortunately, my days of being outgoing and this, that, and the other have gone and passed, and I have lots of memories, but what I regret so much is the fact that there are so many people out there who will not be able to enjoy a lot of memories that I've enjoyed.
Yeah, well...
You know, not to end this on a bad note or anything like that, but I mean, you know, in the past 15 years, I have noticed a definite change in everything in this country. It has just really just gone to hell in a handbasket. It really has. Attitudes of people, they're mean, they're self-serving, and it's like, hooray for me and to hell with you. And it's just not a good sign. And even the people I speak with telephonically or whatever, they all agree. They say, yes, there's a definite change, even a marketable change. I mean, market change, a metric change in human behavior. And God only knows if something catastrophic should ever happen that would, precipitate a real cataclysm.
Well, I mean, I don't remember how many days you were out of electricity last summer, but it was getting a little Lord of the Flies-ish around here. Around day 8 of the derecho power outage.
Oh yeah, God knows. Luckily, I was only out just for an evening, and it was pretty bad. And that was a hell of a night because I can remember you were on the air, and the last thing I heard you say was, "God," and then, boom, everything started going wild. It was a perfectly evening Friday, gentle Friday night, and all of a sudden this thing came upon us, and everybody was in the dark. And with me, I fell tripping over a rug, and in total darkness like that, I mean, you're just totally disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And the days followed up. Remember that week that followed it? It wasn't like there was any rain. It was dry, but it was 102, 103 degrees.
Yeah, it's pretty hot.
And for around here, that is extreme.
Yeah, I know. Going back to what you were saying about Berlin, Berlin's been known to get pretty warm in summer. This is one of the reasons why, Berliners love the lakes around there.
Mm-hmm.
And they all, this has been going on a long, long time, but still, things are really heating up. And I just wonder how much longer power grids can sustain air conditioning to make life livable or whatever.
Well, and that's the thing. Places that didn't used to need it,
they
need it
now.
It is highly unusual to stay in a hotel room like the one I had in Frankfurt. It was late May, and it was a steam bath. And the staff were all appalled. We're sorry the rooms are so warm. It's not usually like this. And all you could do was open the window and hope.
That's right, because they're not built for that in that area of the world, because things are pretty cool and very pleasant, and I think it is indicative of the fact that things are warming up. And. And, I don't know, there's just so much friction, whether it's human friction or whether it's atmospheric friction or all types of frictions. It's just everything now is really beginning to rub together and increase, either whether it's psychological heat or measurable heat. It's just not real good. But, what can I say?
And, people, for some reason or another, more so than in extreme cold, in extreme heat, human beings behave poorly.
Oh, God, yeah, they do. I mean, as far as personally, I can handle the cold, no problem. You can always get warm. But when it starts to get warm and you've got all these accelerated temperatures, I mean, besides getting naked, what else can you do?
Well, and beyond that, you start, can't take any more skin off. No.
Hell no, you can't. I'll tell you one thing right now. I mean, my beloved South Carolina, Lord have mercy. That's one of the reasons that I haven't gone back there. It's because, I just can't take that heat like that. But, I mean, more power to them. It'll get them going, whatever. But I hope you do have a nice 4th of July.
I'll be on the air well before that, so.
Are you?
Yeah, I mean, July 1, July 2, July 3. Yeah, we'll be right here.
Well.
I'd like to get up and go somewhere, but it just doesn't seem terribly likely.
Where would you like to go?
Oh, I'd like to, even though it's hotter than hell, I'd like to go down to Alabama. Just, get, there's a music festival that takes place in the old hometown, like the 19th through the 28th. It's in memory of native son, William Christopher Handy, W.C. Handy, the father of the blues. And it's just an awfully fun time in a nice small town. And I'd love to go down for that, eat some barbecue, you know, and just relax and forget everything for a few days.
Yeah, I like to go to Massachusetts.
That'd be nice, too.
Yep. As a matter of fact, I would like to go to Williamstown.
That's a lovely place.
It is a lovely place. As a matter of fact, that's where Cole Porter had one of his summer homes.
Really? I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Buxton Hill. Beautiful place.
Home of Williams College, right?
I think so. Anyway,
yeah. I did a speaking gig up there. That's the only reason I know, and it's beautiful country.
Absolutely, absolutely. But anyway, I guess that's about all I have to contribute for the evening's broadcast and for whatever. But see, there was one more thing I wanted to say. I can't remember. Like I say, is with the passage of time, the little gray cells do not work.
Oh, I know. I find myself searching for words that should be immediately to mind, and or names, things like that. And they're not there.
Isn't it?
Ah, yeah, it sucketh.
Oh, by the way, I've got another movie to recommend to you if you want.
Okay.
Yeah. Evil Under the Sun.
Well, that sounds fun.
And it's Hercule Poirot, played by Peter Ustinov, Maggie Smith, James Mason. Let me see. Diana
Rigg. That's enough to recommend it, those three cast members.
Diana Rigg. Let's see, who else?
I had a horrible crush on her when I was a little boy.
Oh, well, yeah, she was and still is, in my opinion, a very beautiful woman. But and the whole thing is set in this resort in which there is this murder that is solved by Hercule Poirot. But one thing about it that I love so much, the entire soundtrack of that whole movie is written by guess who?
Who?
Cole Porter.
Ah, okay. Okay, so there's a connection.
As a matter of fact, in the hotel there that's run by Maggie Smith, his name is in the log.
Huh.
Well, yeah, so it's a good movie. Evil Under the Sun.
I will go and find it. I just, there's a lot of other places. I get really frustrated with Netflix because it seems like anything that I want to watch online isn't there. Now, if I want to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre 612, it's right there ready for me to just the minute I want to click play.
I tell you, they have some sick stuff out there as far as I'm concerned, whether it's the Hills Have Eyes or Saw or this, that, and the other. And, you know, you get to the point, who wants to watch that kind of stuff? And what kind of influence does it have upon the human psyche? I mean, good.
Well, I mean, it's supposedly it serves the same summary effect as the audiences got watching Oedipus at the Isthmian or the Olympian theater competitions, but it's way over the top. I don't watch them. I don't either. Give me nightmares.
I mean, I have a whole lot of stuff to watch, but you know, I never do that. Why watch something that you pay for?
Oh goodness me, Jim! I got to get out of here. We're past 9 o'clock. I got to get out of the way for Rick Smith.
Oh, well.
You take care. Have a good weekend, Jim.
And the same to you and your family. Good night.
Bye now. Y'all have a great weekend. I'm sorry I ran over. I got lost. Really, have a great weekend. Take care.